that through the approach that the last two talks have discussed. So fault tolerance, why do we want it? Well, we'd like to build a big quantum computer, but the individual gates that we use to build this quantum computer will not be reliable. And so we expect that in order to have any chance of building a big quantum computer and getting the right answer at the end, we're going to need to encode the qubits in some sort of quantum error correcting code and do our gates in a way that stays within the encoded space and is a fault-tolerant protocol. Now, the typical approaches that people use to fault tolerance, concatenated code, toric code, they have a fairly high overhead. I mean, if you're doing a really, really good job, and then maybe you can get overhead of 100 physical qubits to a single logical qubit. And that's kind of the lower end of what people have done, and frequently it's much higher than that. If you go to the experimentalists and say, well, we'd like to build a computer with, I don't know, let's be modest and say 1,000 logical qubits, but actually that means you're going to need to build 100,000 physical qubits. Well, they're going to be kind of upset, right? They'd rather not have to build that many qubits, given that today building 20 physical qubits is a big deal. The question I wanted to answer when I started this work was, is that really intrinsic? Do we really absolutely need such a big blow up in qubits? And in particular, the existing protocols not only require a large factor of extra qubits, but the ratio of physical qubits to logical qubits increases in the existing protocols as the computer gets larger and larger. The question is, can we get around that? Can we have a constant ratio of physical qubits to logical qubits as the computation gets big? And if so, what's the smallest ratio we can achieve? The answer turns out to be that in principle, it can be, in fact, constant. And not only that, it can be an arbitrarily small constant. Now, there's a certain amount of small print here, which those of you in the front can read. And I'll talk about this fine print throughout the talk, because I want you to be informed consumers when you're buying a fault-tolerant protocol. So what's the basic idea and the basic problems that we have to solve? Well, the basic problem is that if you use just we're imagining computers of arbitrary large size. And as you think about computers of different sizes, the most obvious approach is to use just a single quantum error correcting code, no matter what the size of a computer is. Same code, and we'll just repeat it more times when we have more logical qubits. Okay? And in fact, that's kind of what the existing protocols do, and kind of the reason why they have this overhead problem that I'll mention. So the problem with this approach is that if you have a block of a block of n physical qubits, and you try to do a very long computation with this, well, the n physical qubits will fail with some probability, right? In the worst case, all of them will have errors. That happens with a small probability, p to the minus n, but that's still a constant probability when n is constant. Okay, if you just look at a single quantum error correcting code and use it no matter how big your computation is, sooner or later, a whole block of qubits will fail. You won't be able to correct the error, and then your computation might fail. Okay, so we have to get around that. In order to work on larger and larger computations, we're going to have to use bigger and bigger code blocks. Okay, and naively, you might think bigger and bigger code blocks, well, that means the overhead is going to get worse and worse, right? Because we have more and more physical qubits to the logical qubit that's encoded in this. But it turns out that by encoding many qubits in the same block, you can get around that. And in fact, if you just think about the pure communications scenario, forget about fault tolerance for the moment. So Alice has a perfect quantum computer. She wants to send qubits to Bob, who also has a perfect quantum computer. But the communications channel is noisy. Well, then there's this channel capacity theorem, classically or quantumly, which says that you can send quantum information at a constant rate, constant overhead, ratio of physical qubits to logical qubits, and still correct errors that are occurring at a constant rate per qubit. Okay, and the rate at which you can do this is the channel capacity. So the thing here, and moreover, that when you do this, that the logical error rate you get actually decreases as you get to bigger and bigger block sizes. And the way that works is that you're having a single, not just a single code, but a family of codes that grows as the number of qubits you're sending grows. And this family has the properties that all of these things have constant rate. So the number of logical qubits increases as the size of the block grows, proportionally to the number of physical qubits. But you can still correct errors at a constant rate because you're also adding extra redundancy, right? That's growing also as the code block grows. So what we'd like to do is to put a fault-tolerant version, basically, of this channel capacity theorem and use efficient codes like this, but still have a fault-tolerant protocol that allows us to do gates and without adding any extra overhead or little extra overhead. Okay, so that means the solution is going to be to encode many qubits per block. But if you start to look at fault-tolerant protocols, you'll immediately see a problem with using very large block sizes. So the first one, there's a couple of problems actually. So the first one is that we have to do error correction on these blocks, right? And suppose you use a stabilizer code. So it's a very big block. You have a stabilizer code. If the stabilizer generators have very high weight, then in order to measure the error syndrome, you're going to have to touch a lot of qubits one way or the other. And there's a couple of different methods of doing fault-tolerant error correction. I'll mention that briefly in a little bit. But it turns out that the way around this is not to deal with stabilizer generators that have high weight, but only to use codes that have low-weight generators, LDPC codes. Okay, and so that's where they come into this construction. So the other problem you have with dealing with big block codes is that in order to get a universal set of fault-tolerant gates, we have to use a bunch of Ancilla blocks, okay? And even just to get the computation started, we have to create, you know, the code block in the first place, say with encoded zero states. And if you have a very big block, well, that means the encoding circuit to create it is very big too. And if you have errors during the encoding circuit, that could be a problem. But it turns out that there's some sort of general techniques that can allow you to create these big Ancillas. But the catch is that they also have overhead that grows with the size of the block. So the upshot is that while you might say, well, this means we're encoding many qubits per block, so let's just use one huge block that encodes the whole computation, all of the logical qubits. It turns out that's not the right thing to do. And instead, we want to use blocks that are kind of intermediate in size. Okay, they're not small blocks. They're still pretty big blocks. But they're not everything. They're sublinear in the size of the computation. And the upshot is that, well, we can make these Ancillas using extra overhead. The overhead that we're adding for that is not so much that it's going to ruin our main result of trying to get constant overhead. Okay, so this is kind of an overview of the main problems and solutions. Okay, so let's, before I get started on that, let's talk about some of this fine print. So what is the model of fault tolerance that I'm working with? Well, I'm going to use a bunch of assumptions, some of which are, I mean, basically all of which are fairly standard in the theory of fault tolerance. So one of them is I'm going to deal with local stochastic noise. So that means that on each qubit, an error occurs with some probability. There might be correlations between the types of errors that occur on different qubits. I don't really care about that too much. But basically, it's a probabilistic noise model. Presumably, all of this could be done, again, using more general coherent noise models, maybe even non-Markovian noise models. But I haven't looked at the details of that. I'm going to assume that the errors are just going to keep us in qubits, that there's no leakage errors that take us, you know, outside the regular computational Hilbert space. Again, presumably, that can be released. Parallel gates. In general, for fault tolerance, you need the ability to perform computation in parallel on many qubits. So, of course, I need that now. I'm going to have fresh Ancilla qubits when I need them. We need somewhere to dump the entropy that's coming in from the error correction. If you're familiar with the theory of fault tolerance, these will all seem very familiar. But then the main reason I wanted to make this point about the slide is these last two assumptions. So one thing I'm assuming is that we have long range gates. We have the capability to do gates between qubits that are very far apart from each other geometrically. Okay, maybe we have, you know, some local ion traps that are connected by light. Maybe we have some long wires, however hard it may be. But we have that capability. The other assumption I'm going to make is that we have fast and reliable classical computation. So that, you know, in the middle of the computation, we can do measurements, and then we can process the syncrom classically. We don't have to worry about errors during that processing. Once it's measured, it's all classical. The classical computer is reliable. And that the time it takes to do that is very small. And these two assumptions, while they're not necessary to have the threshold for a fault-tolerant quantum computation, they are needed in my construction. So the result I have about having constant overhead does depend on these two properties. So why is that? Well, so this one is going to be needed because we're going to be dealing with these efficient LDPC codes that have a constant data rate, constant ratio of logical qubits to physical qubits. And you can't do that in a constant dimension when the stabilizer generators are geometrically local. This one, mostly we need to deal with the syncrom decoding, which can take a long time. And I'll get back to that towards the end of the talk. One thing I want to say, I guess, is that this one allows you to cheat if you really take it very seriously, right? Because you could say, oh, well, I have fast and reliable classical computation. I can do an arbitrarily long classical computation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the fault-tolerant thing I'm going to do, and then I'll do an exponential classical computation to figure out the answer. And then I'll ignore the quantum part. Okay, that's cheating. I'm not going to do that. There's two places I use classical computation, but basically it's just for syncrom decoding and for kind of doing straightforward controlling of what quantum gate you should do next.
You don't know how to do that efficiently.
Well, it depends on the code you use, and so we'll get back to that in a minute.
And you can tolerate
latency. You mean in the classical computation?
Yeah.
I'm assuming there's no latency. Maybe you could tolerate a little bit, but when it starts to get when it's an amount that grows with the size of the computation, then it starts to mess up the results. So maybe again you could get around it, but I haven't thought about that too much. Okay. To do these problems in reverse order, I guess. So how do we make ancillas? Well, remember we want to make a really big ancilla block. So it has, you know, some ancilla. So most of the ancillas we use, basically all of the ancillas we use, in fact, are going to be particular states that are encoded in the quantum error correcting code we want to use. And remember, we want to use big code blocks. Okay? So suppose we're using a block that has n physical qubits. Then in order to make the ancilla that we want to do, one way we could do it is we could say, oh, well, we'll take a single qubit and we'll rotate it to whatever ancilla we want to encode, say a particular magic state. And then we'll do the encoding circuit for this code. But you know, frequently, for general stabilizer code, if you have a code with n physical qubits, you're going to need n squared gates to do that. And when n is big, and it's growing, remember, with the size of the computation, then the probability of having an error somewhere in that encoding circuit is going to be very high. And eventually, it's going to get very close to 1. Okay? And so the probability of successfully encoding this ancilla is essentially 0. And in fact, it decreases exponentially with n. So that's a problem. We want to avoid that. We want to have some way of creating this big ancilla without having that occur. And the solution is fault tolerance. Well, OK, but you know, how do we use fault tolerance to do fault tolerance? That's kind of circular. The thing is, we have these other fault tolerant protocols, right? So for instance, we could use a concatenated quantum code. And so we'll create a concatenated quantum code, and then we'll run a fault-tolerant protocol on this concatenated quantum code to make this big ancilla we want. So we have this ancilla, which is a state encoded in the real quantum error-correcting code, but then each of the qubits of that ancilla, of the physical qubits of that ancilla, are themselves encoded using a concatenated quantum code. Okay? And we can do that because the concatenated quantum code makes the error rate, the effective error rate, very small. So we can run these n squared gates without having a very high probability of errors. But of course, then the state that we get here is not the real state, right? It's the state that's encoded using this extra code. We'd like to get rid of that extra code, so we decode it. And the thing is that you can decode this concatenated code level by level. So you have, you know, say five levels of concatenation. You remove one level of concatenation, but the error rate is still pretty low, right? Because you still have four levels of concatenation protecting the code. Then you remove another level of concatenation, and the error rate is not quite as low, but it's still fairly low because there's still three levels of concatenation protecting it. And so you remove each level of concatenation, and each time you do that, the error rate gets higher, but it's only really at the last level that it's a big problem. There's going to be some errors that occur from the next to last level, and you know even a fewer number of errors that occur from the previous level. And so it turns out that the total error rate that you get from decoding this is bounded by some amount, some constant amount that basically depends on what code you're concatenating. And moreover, and this is the really important part, remember we encoded each physical qubit of this ancilla with a separate concatenated code. So that if there's an error that occurs while decoding the concatenation, it only affects one physical qubit of this ancilla. So whereas if we did this thing where we did this encoding circuit on the appropriate state that we wanted, an error somewhere in that encoding circuit could totally mess up on our ancilla. You'll have the wrong logical state. But when we do this concatenation thing and we get an error, it's only going to affect one physical qubit of this ancilla that is itself a quantum error correct encode. Okay? So the logical state then is undisturbed. And that's the important thing. That's what we want in order to be able to plug it into the rest of the fault-tolerant protocol. Okay, so here's a very general way we can make ancillas. But the catch is that this concatenated code is one of those old-fashioned fault-tolerant protocols that uses extra overhead for larger computations. And in particular, in order to do a polynomial-sized circuit like this, the overhead is some poly log in n, where n is the size of the block. Okay, so the total number of qubits needed to do this ancilla creation is n poly log n. Okay, say log to some power a. So as I said, if you did that, if n was proportional to the number of physical qubits in the whole computer, or the number of logical qubits you want to have, then that would be a problem because we're already above constant overhead. So this is where we say let's use intermediate size blocks. So in particular, So if big K here is the number of logical qubits in the whole computer, okay? So let's use K. So R is going to be the rate of the code that we're using. So big K over R is kind of the number of physical qubits you would need if you just encoded all the logical qubits in blocks of this code. But then we're going to use blocks that are smaller than that by a factor log to the a plus 1 big K. I mean, it doesn't have to be log to the a plus 1. It just has to be some power of log that's higher than a. And so then how many extra qubits do we need to make one ancilla? Well, we need n log to the a n. And plugging in this value for n, we find that's k over r times 1 over log k. Okay. So as the computer gets larger, the fractional overhead that's introduced by making one ancilla becomes asymptotically negligible. Okay. And so in particular, it's little o of k over r. So as we get to a very big computer, this is not going to contribute a lot to the overhead. But the catch is that for this to be true, we can only make one such ancilla at a time. Okay, if we're going to have, how many blocks are we going to have? Well, we're going to have k over r over n of these blocks. And if we try to make ancillas for all of them at the same time, well, then the overhead would be this times times that, right? Which would then cancel this 1 over log and more. And so we'd have a polylog overhead again. Okay, so we can't do that. We can only make one block at a time or a small number of blocks. And that's enough for what we need, but it's a little bit annoying. So why do we use these extra ancilla blocks? Well, I'm not going to go through all the fault-tolerant constructions, but frequently use these ancilla blocks to do gates. So for instance, people will usually say, well, we have to have some magic state encoded in the code block, and then we have this magic state injection procedure that will let us do some non-Clifford group gate. Okay? But this is saying that we can only build one of these ancillas at a time, so we can only do one magic state construction at a time. So if the original quantum circuit that you, the logical circuit that you wanted to do was already sequential, that's fine. It's only asking for one gate at a time. If the original circuit was parallel, then there's a problem. You have to make it sequential before I can apply this construction. So that's another catch involved in this construction. Okay. So the next problem was fault-tolerant quantum error correction. So this is why we need LDPC codes, remember. So why is that? Well, in fault-tolerant error correction, there's kind of three methods that people have considered of doing that. So they're named after people, Shor, Steen, and Nil. Now, in most fault-tolerant contexts, certainly with concatenated codes, it seems like Steen and Nil are the best error correction procedures because they involve very little interaction between ancilla qubits and the physical qubits that you're using to store your data. And that's good, right? Because the fewer times, the fewer gates you use to touch your physical qubits, the less opportunity there is for problems to arise, for new errors. But the problem is that Steen and Nil error correction both require large ancillas. In fact, ancillas which are, again, states encoded using the same code that you're correcting. And as I've discussed, those are hard to make. We could make them using this method I just talked about, but that would result in polylog overhead. Because, well, for gates, it's enough to do only one at a time, one logical gate at a time. For error correction, we have to do it on all the qubits in the computer at the same time, or at least some constant fraction of them. Because if we don't, then storage errors will be building up while we're waiting. I mean, we say, oh, let's only do one block, let's only correct one block at a time. So we correct this block, and this block, and this block, and this block. But while we're doing that, there's more errors building up on this first block we corrected, right? And if the number of blocks is increasing with the size of the computation, and it is, then we have to get back to this one at some point before the error rate gets too high for us to correct it, okay? So it's enough to do gates on one block at a time. It's not enough to do error correction on one block at a time. We have to do it on a constant fraction. And we can't do that using Steen and Nil because we don't know how to make the ancillas with constant overhead, okay? So the consequence is we want to use Shor error correction. In Shor error correction, you take a cat state, 000 plus 1111, interact it with the code block. Now, the disadvantage of Shor error correction is that these cat states are very, very fragile. If you have a single phase error on any of the qubits involved in the cat state, then the cat state will give you the wrong, it'll give you the wrong value for a bit of the syndrome. Okay? You can get around this by repeating many times, but if the cat state is too big, the probability of not having a phase error is basically negligible, and you're not really getting any information about the syndrome at all. Okay, so the way around that is to use only small cat states. And it turns out the size of the cat state that you're using is the size, the weight of the generators of the stabilizer. Okay, so that's why we want to use LDPC codes.
If the generators are constant weight, why do fault tolerant syndrome measurement at all? It's not so bad.
No, that's true. So it's not clear what's better, actually. It may depend on the specific code. You can do a non-fault-tolerant syndrome thing, but it's the same kind of consideration because you have to do one gate for every every bit in the syndrome, every qubit that's involved in a particular generator.
Well, I agree it's not obvious which is better, but I think either one would work.
Either one will give you a fault-tolerant protocol, that's right, in the end. Because, well, okay, so I think you really need an LDPC code then. I think you need both properties. For short error correction, I think it's sufficient that it's just that the generators have low weight. Although, no, I'm not sure about that, actually. Yeah, for both cases, you need an LDPC code. But there is some spreading of errors in either case, and it's a question of which one is worse. Anyway, the bottom line is that without LDPC codes, I don't know how to do this at all for any method that we know. Okay. Yeah, that's not completely true. I was having a discussion at lunch of some ideas, so it might be possible. But basically what you need in order to do that is you need some way of making these big ancillas with low overhead. If you can do that, then you might be able to use Steen or nil error correction. Okay, so the bottom line is, as I said, we want LDPC codes. And we want a family of these LDPC codes that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, because we want to have a constant overhead, we want the codes to not add extra overhead. So the code should have a constant rate R as the block size goes to infinity. There's some technical thing that, you know, these codes shouldn't be too rare so that there's a code of about the size that we want it to be. That's not a very hard condition to satisfy, but it is a condition. And then, of course, there's the very important thing that we want this code to be good at correcting errors, right? And if you had a code that has constant rate but doesn't correct errors, it's not going to help very much. So we want a code that can correct errors even if they're occurring with probability p per qubit. And moreover, we want that the code to continue correct errors when there's also errors on the syndrome bits with constant rate, because that occurs with short error correction or if you're doing a non-fault tolerant error correction method. Okay, and we get around that, of course, by repeating the syndrome measurement, but we still have to be able to deduce the correct error. And then I want this code to do a good job of suppressing the logical errors. So I'll incorporate that by this function g of n, so that when we have a code block of size n, and we have, you know, gate errors and syndrome errors occurring at this constant rate, then the logical error rate is about 1 over g over n, or is at most 1 over g over n. And then, of course, we'd like there to be an efficient classical decoding algorithm for this code so that when we measure the error syndrome, we can figure out what the error is and correct it. Okay, so if you have a code family that has all of these properties, then the bottom line is that there exists a threshold error rate that works for computations that are size little o of g of k, and that has overhead arbitrarily close to 1 over r in the limit of large block size. Okay, so so one thing to say is, why do we have this limit on the length of the computation? So notice it's not really a limit on the length of the computation, it's actually a limit on the scaling of the length of the computation with size. So remember, we have the errors suppressed at a rate 1 over g of n. Okay, so as we get to bigger and bigger blocks, then we're gonna suppress the error more and more. But if g over n is a relatively small function, like, you know, n cubed, then if we have a computation that grows, that is, you know, of length n to the fourth, well, then the length of the computation is gonna overwhelm the ability of our code to correct errors. And we'll have, the probability is we'll have a logical error before the computation is over. Okay, so we want to avoid that. So here's the more technical version of the theorem. So we pick some alpha less than 1. And actually, we can't get exactly to g of n. So we take g of k to the alpha is the scaling of the logical computation. We wish to achieve overhead within a factor eta of the rate 1 over r. And we want to get the logical error probability less than epsilon. So then there exists some threshold error rate, which depends on eta. And there exists a minimum size computation that we have to deal with. We have to get to big enough computations so that all of this kicks in and so that there are no sublinear terms that are important. And that depends on all the parameters here. Then, of course, if the error rate, the physical error rate per gate is below this threshold value and the size of the computation is above this minimum size, then we can do fault-tolerant logical computation with overall logical error less than epsilon and overhead less than eta over r. So 1 over r is the ideal rate, right, if we just used the code and had nothing else going on. And so this factor eta, which we can make arbitrarily close to 1, is kind of the fudge factor to account for all of the extra ancillas and error correction stuff that we need to do. So I should say that this part of the theorem only depends on the first four properties. It doesn't depend on the efficient decoding algorithm because I've allowed free classical computation. You know, so even if you have an exponential decoding algorithm, that's subsumed in free. But of course, you don't want that. But the advantage of this protocol is that if you do have an efficient decoding algorithm, then it doesn't mess that up. You're still using it. It should be an efficient decoding algorithm for the robust problem, the problem where there's errors during the error syncron. Okay, so that's the main theorem. Then for the, maybe I should stop, see if there's questions on this theorem in the either technical or non-technical versions. Yeah?
What about the classical analogy to this? I thought there was this conjecture for classical codes that you needed to have a logarithmic overhead. And
yeah.
Is this somehow better than classical codes?
Yeah, okay. Good question. Okay, so it turns out, so it depends a little bit on the model of classical computation that you're working with. One model that people have studied and actually proven that you need to have at least logarithmic overhead, I think, is where you're given data that's not encoded, and then you're supposed to encode it and do fault-tolerant computation, and then decode it and hand it back. Now, in that case, there's always going to be some error in the encoding and decoding step, and it turns out that you also need at least logarithmic overhead. Now, probably a somewhat better model is where you're given computation. So you're given data that's already encoded in an error-correcting code of your choice, and you do your computation on it, and then you hand it back in that same code. In that case, it's not known whether you need, but of course, that means that nobody knows how to do it with constant overhead. So how can I do better than that? Well, the main reason is because I'm pushing the syndrome thing onto classical computation. And so that allows me to bypass this. And if you actually counted the amount of classical computation needed, even for the very best codes that we know, I think it would take you to log overhead. But I can get back to that at the very end, actually. It's an interesting question. Yeah?
So you mentioned that we cannot use skin error correction because repairing ancillas would have overhead. But for error correction, we need very simple ancillas like encoded zeros and encoded
states. Yeah. So the problem is not the logical state. The problem is the error correcting code state. So you need some way of making this error correcting code that a logical zero, say, in this error correcting code that you can do this encoding without any extra overhead.
But can we just prepare each physical qubit in zero state and then measure X stabilizers?
For an LDPC code, that would probably work. But for an LDPC code, then you can do other methods of error correction too. For a non-LDPC code, it's not going to work because, because to measure the error syndrome, you would need big cat states or some other method like a big ancilla. And we don't know how to do that. Okay? No other questions? Okay, so then let me move on to talk about what LDPC codes we know, or what families of codes we know, that will satisfy all these properties. So there's basically three families that seem to have the right properties that we want, that we know of, but maybe some of you out there have come up with some additional ones that I don't know about. So the first one, say, is the hypergraph product codes that were mentioned maybe in the past couple of talks. So those are pretty good distance, right? They have distance n to the 1/2 with constant data rate. But unfortunately, we don't know any good decoding algorithm for those, exponential time decoding. So then another family of codes that people pointed out to me after I posted the first version of the paper are hyperbolic topological codes. So in particular, the hyperbolic surface codes, they have distance log n, which it turns out is enough to give error suppression. And moreover, they have a polynomial time decoding algorithm through, say, maximum matching. But they're not great for another reason, which is that they don't have very good error suppression, basically because its distance is not very big. So that's a problem. Then there's the 4D hyperbolic topological codes. And those, it turns out, have a distance that's n to some power. So that's pretty good again. But unfortunately, we don't have an efficient decoding algorithm that takes advantage of this full distance. There is a nice algorithm by Matt Hastings, which is polynomial time and actually much more efficient than the maximum matching. But it only gives polynomial error suppression too. So I'll say that in a moment. So now let me go through and say a little bit more about these codes. So the hypergraph product codes, I'm not going to go through the construction, but basically it takes two classical codes and it puts them together to get a quantum code. Not in the CSS way, in a different way. And in particular, if you use two LDPC codes, you put them together, you can get a quantum LDPC code. If you use the same code twice, so it's parameters NKD, then the quantum code has parameters given here, basically the square of n and k, and then d is the same. So you can see from here where the d is like square root of n comes from, because n and k get squared, d does not get squared. So if you start with a classical code that has a constant relative distance, d over n is constant, then over here you're going to have d is about square root of the number of qubits. But you do notice that k gets squared too. So if this code had a constant rate, k over n constant, then here we're also going to have a constant rate. Okay? And in particular, let me point out that by choosing an appropriate family of classical codes where k over n is close to 1, then this rate here you can also make close to 1. Okay? Because this n minus k squared becomes negligible when k is near to n. Okay, so we can make quantum LDPC codes this way with constant rate, but we can make quantum LDPC codes with rate arbitrarily close to 1. So that's a nice thing, and that's why if you plug that into this theorem, well, you can make this R arbitrarily close to 1, and so this overhead can be arbitrarily small. That's what I said, it's an arbitrarily small constant. But unfortunately, as I said, we don't have a good decoding algorithm for the hypergraph product codes in general, even when we have a good decoding algorithm for the classical code. And that's kind of for the reasons that David talked about in the morning, that belief propagation doesn't work so well. So that's one family of codes. It's good if we're allowed free classical computation, not so good if we start to count the classical computation for something. So let's move on to the hyperbolic surface codes. So how do they work? Well, if you take the construction of the toric code and you do it on a hyperbolic surface, well, everything works just the same. The logical qubits are still associated with non-trivial loops that go all the way around this hyperbolic surface. And the logical operators, and therefore the distance is the smallest distance going around this. And it turns out that by picking the hyperbolic manifold that you're working on very cleverly, you can make it multiply connected in such a way that the number of logical qubits, which is the number of distinct, topologically distinct logical loops, is proportional to the number of physical qubits. But the distance is more than constant. In fact, in particular, it's proportional to log n. Okay? So that's nice. And because it's just like the toric code, when you have a bunch of errors, you can think of them as forming chains. And at the end of these chains are defects that are visible as syndrome bits that are not satisfied. And so the decoding process It's a matter of matching up these defects, which is a standard graph theory algorithm called maximum matching. Okay, so that's an efficient polynomial time algorithm. So therefore, these codes, even this version of them, has an efficient algorithm for decoding. So that's good. But of course, the distance is not very good, right? It's only log n, whereas for hypergraph product codes, we had n to the 1/2. So then let's go to the 4D hyperbolic codes. So if you take the toric code construction, generalize it to four dimensions, and do it on an appropriate choice of hyperbolic manifold, again, you can get a constant number of constant rate of logical qubits. K over n is constant. And so in the 2D case, we had the loops, the non-trivial loops, had to be at least length log n. That meant the distance was log n. In the 4D case, we again have the non-trivial loops have to be at length log n. But now the errors are not loops, they're surfaces. Okay? And to get in a hyperbolic manifold, the volume of a disk grows exponentially with the radius of the disk. And so if we have a disk that has radius about log n, then the number of bits, number of locations to fill in this disk, which is the weight of an error, is going to be exponential log n, which is n to some power. And it turns out we know that for this family of codes that this power has to be less than 0.3. So these codes are not quite as good as the hypergraph product codes in terms of distance, but they're different family of codes, and so maybe there's some better hope for finding a decoding algorithm. Certainly in the case of the 2D code, hyperbolic code, we had a decoding algorithm. What about the 4D case? Well, we don't know how to decode to this full distance of the code, but there is this algorithm that I mentioned by Matt Hastings, which doesn't fully take advantage, but is polynomial time. So before I say any more about that, let me mention that what we're really interested is not a decoding algorithm for the code in the communication sense, but a decoding algorithm when there's errors occurring in the syndrome. So first of all, you may have noticed that all of the codes I mentioned have sublinear distance. And you might say, well, how is that going to work? Because we have n qubits, error rate p per qubit means that there's going to be about pn errors. And how do we possibly correct that? And the answer is we don't have to correct the worst case error. We only have to correct the typical error. And as Leonid and Alexei told us in the last two talks, there's this percolation threshold, where if errors are occurring randomly, then they'll tend to form small clusters. And we can correct the clusters separately. So when we're below that percolation threshold, we should be able to do error correction. And moreover, that percolation threshold still is true even when we're thinking about syndrome errors. Okay, so by adding an extra dimension, you'll still get small clusters of where the errors appear. And so we should be able to correct them. But unfortunately, we don't know an efficient way to do that in general. Okay, and that's why the hypergraph product codes, even at constant low error rate, we don't have an efficient decoding algorithm. Okay, so if you plug into those results about the percolation threshold and the error suppression rate, you'll find that the logical error rate goes something like p over p sub t. P sub t is some threshold value to a power that's proportional to the distance of the code. Okay, and so this is why I was making a big deal about the distance of the code. So if you have a hypergraph product code, that means that the logical error rate is exponential and minus n to the 1/2. Okay. Now remember, I said that the longest error scaling that we could tolerate in our code was basically little o of 1 over this error suppression rate, right? This thing was 1 over g. And that was the longest computation we could do. So this thing means we can do a computation of size about e to the square root of n before we see a problem. Okay, so certainly we can do any polynomial length computation. So that's good. We like that. But as I said, we don't know an efficient decoding algorithm for these hypergraph product codes. No. You could always add extra qubits, but then you're not doing constant overhead anymore. So yeah, so that would probably be a problem. Grover doesn't use very many qubits, so maybe you don't care about using extra qubits. So let's see, what's next? Hyperbolic surface codes. So the hyperbolic surface codes, remember, they only had a distance of log n. So what does that mean in terms of error suppression? That's p over p sub t to the o of log n, which is n to some power that depends on p sub t over p. And actually, there's you know, some additional factors, polynomial factors in front of here. So, but the thing is that you can still make this polynomially decaying. And moreover, you can make it decay with any polynomial rate that you like. You just have to pick the error rate p to be sufficiently far below this parameter p sub t, which is no longer really the threshold value. Okay, and so that's kind of okay at a theoretical level. It means that if we have a computation that we want to do of some particular length, f of n, we just have to say, oh, we'll pick a polynomial that's bigger than f of n, and we'll let the error rate be small enough so that the errors are suppressed enough that we can do that computation. Okay, so where this differs from the usual threshold theorem says there's a threshold value. If you're below that threshold, you can do arbitrarily long computations. Now, my version of the threshold theorem says there's a threshold value. If you're below that threshold value, you can do polynomial length computations with constant rates. Suppose you're doing this hypergraph product thing. But this one says, well, you have to decide what polynomial length computation you want to do. And depending on that, you have to pick a smaller threshold if it's a long polynomial, a big polynomial. Okay, so it's a little different from the usual threshold theorem in that there's not a universal threshold, but instead a threshold that depends on the kind of computation you're doing. So that's a little bit unpleasant. No. So non-fault tolerant computation says, okay, so yeah. So the non-fault tolerant computation says that the error rate that you have to use is dependent on the size of the computation you want to do. This one says that the error rate you have to use depends on the scaling of the computation you want to do. So there's a threshold here. If you want to do Shor's algorithm and you know you're not doing anything clever, you'll say that's going to take time n cubed. Okay, and I can do any Shor's algorithm with the same threshold error rate for any size number. Okay, whereas without fault tolerance, you have to get lower and lower error rates to factor bigger and bigger numbers. That's the difference. Okay, so then let's go to this last case, the 4D hyperbolic codes. So now we have both things going on, both possibilities here. So we have, because the distance is n to the epsilon, we have, you know, suppression, error suppression, e to the minus n to the epsilon. So we should be able to do polynomial length computations for arbitrary polynomials. But we don't know how to do error correction for that. On the other hand, we have this Hastings algorithm, which gives polynomial error suppression, just kind of the same way as this hyperbolic surface code, and is efficient. In fact, it has depth log n, so it's quite efficient. But this polynomial length error suppression again means that the threshold will depend on the scaling of the computation that you want to do. So it's unsatisfactory for that way. But there's some hope here that maybe you know Hastings' algorithm could be improved, or maybe it's just the analysis that needs to be improved, or there's some other algorithm that for these 4D hyperbolic codes, which you know they have a lot more structure than the general hypergraph product codes. So I think there is some hope for getting an efficient decoding algorithm that does get error suppression that's like this, but it's still a polynomial time decoding algorithm. So that's very hopeful. Okay, so that's kind of what I wanted to say. And maybe again, I'll hit these points of the drawbacks because they point the way to future things that would like to be done. So one is that this only works for a sequential circuit. I mentioned that, right? That if you start with a parallel circuit, you have to make it sequential. So you're taking a big blow up in time in exchange for working with a small blow up in space. It doesn't have to be quite as extreme as I said. You can have some parallelism in time and still still work for large enough computations with a constant overhead. But I don't know how to make it completely parallel. And it would be nice to get to get away around that. I don't know how to do that. Another thing is that this is very much an asymptotic result, that you need big codes in order for to get near the asymptotic rate. And then there's all these sublinear terms that I was neglecting, but actually can be pretty big numbers. So what we'd of course like to do is have similar protocols, or you know, completely different protocols, that work for much smaller computations, so that could be usable in the near future on you know quantum computers people are building in 10 years or 20 years. And yet we'll still have low overhead. And then of course there's these two constraints about need for non-local gates and fast classical computation, which are used very intrinsically in my protocol, but you'd like to be able to get around. But the bottom line is that we shouldn't be satisfied with fault-tolerant protocols that have really high overhead. There's no, in principle, reason it needs to be high. It's just a question of, can we find a protocol that satisfies all the criteria we'd like to and does better? There's obviously still work to be done on better LDPC codes or better decoding algorithms. So that's something that I'm sure we'll be discussing more in this workshop. And it would be nice to get this to work for small quantum computation. Since I still have a few minutes left, let me say maybe a few words about the prospects for getting around these. So the nice thing about Hastings algorithm, as I mentioned, it has only depth log n. But the other thing that's nice about it is that the amount of classical computation needed is actually quite small. It's basically the way the algorithm works. It's pretty simple. The analysis is maybe a bit more complicated. But you look at kind of random balls. You have this hyperbolic manifold, and you take some ball, and a bunch of these different balls. And you look in this ball, and you see, well, in the 40 torque code, the error syndromes that you see are basically chains. They're one-dimensional things. And so you'll see some chain that enters this ball and wiggles around and leaves the ball. Okay, and his algorithm is just, well, look at where it enters, where it leaves, find the shortest path between those inside the ball, and modify the chain, you know, do some additional bit flips or phase flips to make the chain into that shortest path. Okay, and then what he shows is that the chains will shrink with time. And in time log n, they'll basically be gone. I mean, you'll have new errors occurring all the time, of course, so that will create new chains. But basically, this is where the error suppression comes from. And see, the thing is, to do that, all the classical computation you need really is just looking at this ball. I mean, he has a little bit more about choosing these balls. They're not totally random. They don't want to be overlapping or anything like that, sufficiently far apart. But it seems very plausible to me that it could be done with a minimum of classical computation. And that's kind of halfway to releasing this condition on fast classical computation. Now, the other half is that I still need classical computation for magic state injection and whatever ancilla-based constructions you might have. But you know, maybe there's another way around that, too, using a different family of codes. I don't know, high-dimensional anions that do things by braiding or something and don't have magic state injection. So maybe there's some hope to actually even do the classical thing without using the classical assumption and therefore beat, really, really beat the classical result. Non-local gates, I don't really have any concrete idea how to do that, but maybe if you have some LDPC code that has this constant rate but has only a small number of non-local generators, right? It has most of the generators are geometrically local, and there's occasional ones that stretch further. And moreover, maybe you only need to check those long distance ones very rarely, right? So the local ones are enough to do most of the error correction, but occasionally you need to check the longer ones. And maybe that would let you do this working in, say, two or three dimensions and still get this result. But that's just speculation. I don't have any idea really how to do that. Anyway, that's it. Thanks. Yeah,
I don't think I followed the remark you made about really, really beating the classical case. I mean, what quality of quantum mechanics would make it so that you could really, really beat the classical case, and you would have more errors to contend with.
You do have more errors to contend with, but you also have more control, more options for doing gates. I mean, I don't know. It's just speculation, so I don't know that it can be done at all. But and it may be that it's possible to do it classically, it's just no one's come up with a method, because they don't. It's not a really big research topic in classical computation. People work on it, but not that much. Okay, so many questions. So let's start on this end. John.
So I'm surprised that Hastings decoder doesn't have exponential suppression. I mean, it just works by smoothing out the string.
Yeah, it's possible it does. It's possible it does, and it's just that his analysis maybe is not good enough to show that.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Can you put the chart up with the different codes?
Yes.
So maybe I'm not thinking about this right. I thought the motivation for going from the 2D hyperbolic to the 4D was this systolic freedom. And so I thought that meant that you would get better than n to the 1/2, but this looks.
No. What you get is n to the epsilon instead of log n.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at the. Okay, I wasn't.
Yeah, so it is better than the 2D case. It's just not better than the hypergraph.
But not when you're doing the log decoder. Okay.
Yeah.
So in your scheme, you divide logical qubits into blocks, and you prepare ancillary states for each block sequentially. And I can imagine that it would lead to some extra time overhead. For example, in magic state distillation. So do you think it's only logarithmic hex overhead?
Okay, so first of all, the magic state distillation happens while creating the ancilla. That's part of this concatenated code protocol. Okay, so it's not a separate thing. I don't have to do that again, because I've already made it very reliable. There is some time overhead. If you count the number of ancillas you need at the same time, it works out okay. Because, so you have to be a little more careful than the numbers that I was throwing around. But basically, the depth of that, so the number of ancillas you're building at once is like the depth of the ancilla creation circuit, which is very good because the concatenation is like log depth, right? It's just the number of levels of concatenation. So that's, you know, a small additional factor that again becomes negligible because the size of the ancilla is small compared to the whole computer. Was there more to that question, or was that it? Okay. Okay, let's work back, and then, so David.
Okay, so maybe this is a little bit an aside, but I mean, can you think of any quantum algorithm that does not benefit from parallelism of non-triplet gates? A lot of these circuits have been worked out in detail.
Not offhand. So obviously Shor's algorithm is a famous example where we do know how to parallelize it. There's not that many algorithms that are really interesting so that people have thought about. I mean, there's all sorts of algorithms that are, you know, Oracle-based algorithms, and probably most of those we don't know how to parallelize, but no one's really worked on parallelizing them.
Well,
so.
I mean, a lot of them is just classical arithmetic, right? So you're going to be
sometimes
Copley gates all the time.
Sometimes. I haven't thought about it.
So there's not one example?
There might be, but I haven't, like I said, I haven't thought about it, so I couldn't tell you.
So in your constructions, is there any kind of a natural trade you can have between the non-locality of the operations you allow and the overhead you permit? If you only allow logarithmic size operations, and it would give you a certain overhead in your constructions, and end up with linear or some other kind of back and forth.
I mean, that's mostly a property of the codes. So you'd have to look at families of codes, and I don't know. Barbara, do you know anything about that?
No, I don't know. I think it's an interesting question to have some kind of strategy.
But I mean, the bound that
have random.
The bound that we have in the paperweight circuit, there's a if you make the stabilizer non-local and you put a parameter on this algorithm unstable, then there's, I think it just show up as it gets multiplied by d gets multiplied by this non-local scale.
If you have a constant k over n.
No. What I'm saying is that if you allow for non-local stabilizers.
Yeah. And you have some scale of non-locality. That the distance you can, the bound on the distance you can achieve.
There is a parameter that characterizes that.
Okay. So I guess something is known about that.
Yeah, but I mean, typically you may want to have a family of very local and more non-local stabilizers, and that's not covered by that. That's some kind of randomness.
Right.
And I don't think anybody's explored that.
Right.
Yeah. That's my question about non-locality. I'm just wondering, the non-locality comes from the choice of code family that you're
So it's known that in finite dimensions, you cannot have an LDPC code that where the generators are geometrically local, and you have constant d over n and really more than constant distance.
Okay.
In this one is kind of obvious where the non-locality comes from, it's just all over. These ones you might be a little surprised because they do have geometrically local check generators. But the thing is, it's in hyperbolic space,
right,
which cannot be locally embedded or isometrically embedded in our regular Euclidean space.
Right, because that seems to be the major, like, experimental, not major.
Now, I guess if you want to take advantage of the cosmological constant, maybe there's something you can do there. Yeah?
In future work, do you hope to choose an array, pick an algorithm, work out the number of qubits and time required?
Yes, I hope that will be future work done by somebody else.
I have a PhD student working on this.
Okay, good. Yeah.
So you think that for the 4D hyperbolic code, just cooling would work?
You mean because they're self-correcting?
No. I mean using a decoder which is just annealing, simulated annealing.
I think that's sort of the intuition behind Hastings' algorithm. Maybe. But
so this one is fully parallelized.
Yeah. No, I mean, Hastings, like I said, it's log depth. So obviously that's a parallel algorithm. So it is a very good algorithm. I mean, it's just a question of what actually error suppression it gives. OK? Thanks.